Hi, so welcome back to another episode of the No Scrubs podcast. I'm Anthony.
And I'm Cushy.
And my honor to welcome Sarah Berger, our newest guest. Thank you for being here with us.
Thank you too. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited to get to talk with y'all.
That's great. So a little background. Sarah is one of the pre-health advisors here at Dartmouth, and that's how I met her. And is there anything else you'd like to let us know, Sarah, maybe about how you came to be a pre-health advisor, what it's like to be a pre-health advisor?
Sure, yeah. Pre-health advising is one of those roles you don't even really kind of know it exists until you find out about it. And so I was doing work that was kind of centered around wellness for a long time. I had a private practice and then also started working at Dartmouth, actually in the phys ed department, working with the fitness center and wellness programming and non-alcoholic programming for students. And so I actually segued to this position. It was a lot of new information to learn, but the experience of working with people one-on-one, the experience of working with people in groups, of facilitation, those are things I've been doing a long time. And I love translating that into the direct work with students. And I think the pre-health path is such a fascinating journey and such a complex and interesting journey and such a human journey that I personally, and I think a lot of pre-health advisors feel this way, that it's a spot in the universe of work that you don't know exists. And then when you find out about it, it's very exciting, in terms of the type of aspiration that you're walking through with people. It's very deep for a lot of people, and there are a lot of moving parts. So it's a really interesting blend of both like practical and sort of soulful work. So I love that.
It's really interesting that you mentioned that it's something people don't realize exists until they kind of are presented with it. Just through like a quick Google search of the pre-health advising here at Dartmouth, I noticed that it was started by Dr. Lee Witters. And kind of before that, there wasn't a formal advising program.
That's right.
So was it before that here at Dartmouth, was it just kind of system of students go to a professor they trust, they might listen to a loved one? Was there really any advising before that?
Yeah, what it was it was placed in career services. It's what we now call the Center for Professional Development was called Career Services. And there was someone in career services who always had as a primary duty to advise pre-health students, but they were also a general career service person as well. And so Dr. Witters had gotten involved with the Nathan Smith Society, Cushy, that's a student pre-health organization on campus. And he began to observe that there was a real, an insufficiency to be able to cover all the bases for all the students of interest. And that it was more than just the logistics of doing an application. It was the whole process from the day students walk in the door and past the day they graduate, since we work with so many alumni. So he really advocated for pre-health to have its own place in the Dartmouth universe. And so I was the first person hired to be a full-time pre-health advisor at Dartmouth. And for the health professions program, and so those first couple of years, Dr. Witters was part-time also doing advising along with his teaching. That's how it got started. We had to build a reputation, I guess that you could say, because it's not that students didn't use it before, they did, but again, it was more transactional. Building the sort of campus reputation of it being an office that was trustworthy and welcoming and that one could come for a whole range of topics was part of the mission for me personally on those first few years.
That's a really interesting take. I actually never thought about it from that perspective before. So the next question that we have for you is have you noticed any kind of stigma or towards like certain healthcare professions or like a biasness towards it just in Dartmouth or just in general?
I do think that is probably to some degree that is probably the case. I'd say that sort of Dartmouth naturally attracts students who are very very accomplished. And so the orientation is to move towards the position that seems sort of maybe the one that has the, that is seen to be the one that has the most leadership, which is often promoted as the physician position. So that's, I think, not only do we have students who genuinely are interested in that path, but I think that on top of that, it does appear to a lot of students to be a bit more prestigious or have a higher status. And so I think that does affect people. We do talk to students who have an interest in nursing, for instance, and I think that one is maybe the hardest one for some students, because it does have, I think people have an association with it as being, you know, somehow not quite as high of a status, and yet it's an amazing profession with amazing leadership opportunities and even the ability to have a private practice, depending on the path one takes. Physician assistant doesn't seem to have the same stigma, but I think a lot of people don't necessarily know about it. And so if they're like, well, if I'm going to be a physician assistant, they're like, well, I might as well be a physician. I think that's, but I think sometimes when people really do the research, then they start to realize they're like, actually, this feels like physician assistant or nursing would really suit the lifestyle I want and the career I want and help me get to my career faster. And we certainly do see an interest in dental and veterinary medicine as well. And then occasionally there are people who crop up who are, you know, physical therapy or audiology or, you know, with, sort of speech therapy, that optometry. So there are things that crop up. There's things we may not hear about because students may not realize we'd be happy to support those things that students might go off and independently pursue.
Is there a way that, I don't know if there's a project underway or something like that for the pre-health advising, maybe to show students these other professions in healthcare? Because I have, like, through conversations, heard people talking about, oh, maybe this class is really hard for me. I don't know if I'm cut out to be a doctor, or I don't know if I'm cut out for those 4 years plus residency fellowship. Mm-hmm. And then they feel like they have to give up their desire to be a part of the healthcare system in a way. Mm-hmm. Is there a way that we can let our campus know, and maybe just students in general know, that they don't have to be a doctor or nothing? There is something else they can do.
Actually, that's a great thought. And actually, Alicia Ken, who's our other advisor, and I were talking about this today about if we could do more on campus this year to just promote the fact that there are other professions. And we have, in the past, I have done panels where I brought people from different professions in. I've got to tell you, they were not well attended at all. And so I think that, you know, finding that dance between bringing people in and having them take their time to spend their time and, you know, promoting that opportunity. We kind of always have to do that balance in our limited sense of time. But no, I actually agree with you. I think that there could probably be more that we could do to not only bring in guests who talk about their profession, but actively, you know, promote the fact that there are other professions, period. And even in so doing, that actively uplifts not only their existence, but their status, if that makes sense. Not only does it inform people that there are options, but it makes them, it normalizes them as possibilities.
That's actually interesting, because I would have thought that getting any kind of medical-based degree from Dartmouth or any of the Ivy Leagues would just as be like seen in a similar way. But from what you said, it could be a little difficult for students to navigate through that.
Yeah, and you don't, the only degree, a medical degree you can get at Dartmouth is physician. I think you're right. I think if Dartmouth as a whole offered other types of health profession education, what you're saying would be actually so true. But we have a med school here, so that also, I'm sure, complements the sort of physician image as well. But yeah, we have nothing nearby that has any other health profession school. So I guess that's not, there is a school not so far that has a physical therapy, a PA program actually. And we had somebody come in from that, but it has been a little while. I think one thing that the remote experience has shown is that sometimes doing webinars is a really great way to get more people like in the room for workshops. And also it's easier for people, guests, to come without maybe having as much effort. So, you know, a smaller group is still really worth doing.
I think what's interesting is the point you mentioned about how Dartmouth has a medical school, and through that, you can only become a doctor. And so it's kind of, I don't know if it's consciously or subconsciously, it only attracts people who want to be doctors in the undergraduate system because they see that feeder kind of into the graduate program. So I guess that kind of segues into the fact that pre-health students, pre-med students, they get influenced by their loved ones, by their professors, by their advisors. And it's kind of like, what advice do you listen to? Because there might be that one exam you don't do that well in, and then all of a sudden you go to your advisor and they're telling you, you know, maybe bio isn't cut out for you. Maybe chem isn't what you should be doing. And then they make you start to question yourself. So how is it that as an advisor, you can balance between allowing a student to have those realistic expectations of, I can be successful at this, I can be happy with what I'm doing, versus, I guess, just crushing their dreams? Because some students, they say that negative feedback is ultimately what makes them stop pursuing that dream, or vice versa, that negative feedback is what fuels them to prove somebody wrong.
Mm-hmm. And that what you just said is very interesting too, because people do take it different ways. And so it is a very personal experience of how feedback is received. But your point is well taken. I mean, I've talked to a lot of students who've experienced either what felt like an overt kind of discouragement, like, why are you doing this? Or you should do something else, very like direct, or something that felt more subtle subtle or unwitting kind of pressure around feeling as if perhaps someone didn't have faith in them or their abilities. So I think that is a really crucial question and something that has kind of fueled me almost since I started to know that students experience that, whether it was from, like you said, it could be a loved one, it could be a trusted mentor or advisor, it could be just a buddy, and it could be a professor. There could be different reasons, you know, that those people are thinking those things. They could be wanting to relieve that this is somebody I care about and they seem to be suffering and I want to relieve them of suffering. And so if this is causing you suffering, why would you want to keep doing this? Just give it, like, move on. You know, there's that type of reason. There can just be like, I wish you had more time to hang out. Why, you know, just let it go. It's causing you a lot of agony. So if you stop doing it, we could hang out more. You know, there's that type of reason. and then of course there can be, you know, subconscious or unwitting or subtle biases that can also take root in that. And I think, you know, our social, you know, that's been a lot in the conversation, right? Socially, it's been there for a long time, but I think the conversations are a bit more on the surface now around, you know, people looking at their unconscious biases. And, you know, that can be anybody from a mentor to a parent to a professor, making assumptions about what it means if somebody's struggling. I think that, you know, and students might themselves also then want to question, like, where is it coming from, and feel troubled by, like, you know, someone's perception of them, which is really hard. So on a personal level, I have a very strong passion for sort of insisting that if anybody really wanted to do this path, that they can. I would never, as an advisor or a human, in my case, just because of how I view it and what I've observed, perceive that somebody who struggled a little bit, that the conclusion from that was, you know, that they couldn't do it, just because I've seen it play out successfully so often. But not everybody has seen that. So my sense is when a student is faced with that, you know, I maybe have to parse out, you know, what could have felt hurtful, a sort of sense of somebody lacking faith in them or being critical, based on anything ranging from just, I want to relieve you from suffering, to whatever association that person may have had. If it's sometimes a student of color, sometimes feels like they're feeling like weighted down by stereotypes. I've certainly talked to students who have felt that way. Just this week, you know, I talked to somebody who felt a little like that, or just the sense that, you know, whoever the other person may be, just, you know, has their own vision of what success looks like. So my thought is always how to approach a student so that it's separate from whatever anybody else thinks. How do they circle back to what their original intent was? And if separate from any types of worries of other people's perception, they still feel a strong interest in what they're moving towards, how then to work through bumps. You know, lots of people are adjusting how to study better. Lots of people have to learn more about learning in the process of diving into this material at the level of college. Lots of people didn't get as much science as other people. You know, there's all sorts of reasons why somebody might hit bumps. And some of them could just be like a person didn't really realize how much time they had to commit yet. And they weren't really willing yet to commit that level of time yet. It hadn't really sunk in yet. Somebody really just didn't get as much science background and really just needs to kind of catch up. And that's just factually true, but it doesn't have anything to do with their ability or capacity. And so, I mean, I've seen people go through really rocky times, many people, and still go to med school. And that can be that they had a great upward trajectory during college, or it could be that they paused, circled back to it later in college, and then finished classes after they graduated. It could be that things were but maybe a little bit rough the whole time they were at college and they did have to go and do more coursework after the fact. But if the goal and the core interest stayed strong and the motivation had enough energy to fuel, I've seen this. I mean, I've just seen so much success. Like I have no belief anymore. I never did actually that if somebody has a little bit of a rocky time on a test or even a class or even a year, that is indicative of like their absolute potential. If somebody keeps struggling, they're doing everything under the sun, then it's time to look at like, well, what else is going on? Is there a learning issue? Do they need to talk to someone in accessibility? You know, they're doing everything under the sun. That's a whole other thing that could be resolved. If somebody is hanging in there, but hasn't made any changes to how they study or learn, that's a different issue, right? It's figuring out, you know, how to get the support, the academic support to actually have their, all that effort go in the direction of making it better. So there's a lot of things that can be considered way before anybody would say, maybe this isn't for you. If somebody shows a lack of interest or lack of enthusiasm, if somebody seems really sad that they're pursuing this because like they've just felt like they had to, that's a totally different issue. You know, there may be times when I might sit with somebody and be like, so is this what you want? That's a totally separate question than if somebody had some rocky experiences in their academics and completely separate conversation. Those two things could connect. If somebody really was on a train they couldn't get off of, that could affect how their motivation is for studying. That's a totally different issue. So I don't know. I guess I feel really passionate about people knowing that their capacity and ability is completely separate from, you know, running into, challenges or bumps along the way, as long as it's a genuine sustained interest. And sometimes I've worked with students, sometimes they have felt a little like, you know, after a while and just taking a term off from all that and pause, do something experiential, do something that reminds them if this is something they really even want to kind of refuel the energy. It takes a lot of work to do this. I don't think a lot of people know just what it takes to even get to med school, much less, you know, what you do after that. So it's a big journey. And, you know, it's understandable that people would have many different versions of it.
Actually, I really resonate to that because our entire pre-PA curriculum is kind of set up in a way wherein we take science classes one semester and then the other semester we have much more clinical exposure and hands-on experiences. So it's kind of helping us keep the vision while also preparing for PA school.
That's so great. That's really nice.
So do you think that one of the basic reasons where somebody could like be wavering from the decision from pre-med or pre-PA or any of the pre-health professional tracks are when the classes get tough? So do you think readout classes in a sense are real, or is that something just we as students have it in our minds?
Yeah, I can, excuse me. I don't think I can speak for all schools. because there could be schools where they have more of that mentality, or certain professors, you know, somewhere. I would say I have inquired about this, you know, amongst a lot of people, and I honestly don't think that's the mindset of the vast majority of professors. I don't think there's an intent to weed out. I truly don't. I can't speak for every single, you know, person's perception of, you know, what does it mean to have a pre-health student? I love this topic, and this pre-health student seems to be in it just to sort of check a box. And it's possible some professors who really love their topic would love everybody in the class to love their topic, right? So, I mean, I think that can be felt sometimes, but I think for the most part, the system of how assessment works in terms of grading and such, then I think it naturally yields a sense of being weeded out. I don't understand the curve process myself all that well, and the grading process all that well, having not been on that side of that myself. But I think that the mindset of faculty is, how can we best assess if students are learning the material? And how do we do that in a relative way? So that if I've made a test that was especially rigorous, the students, that's why, you know, I think that's why a curve exists, you know. So yes, people are getting compared to each other, but I think what they're really trying to do is, I have to have some marker for determining if people are understanding the material. I think that's what it's meant to be anyway. And I know that in the end, then people feel that they can be being weeded out because of that being so. But I want to encourage people so much not to weed themselves out or to be weeded out by that process, as tempting as it can be. And again, when you have, you know, most people coming into pre-health were often, no matter what school they've gone to, are often high achieving students, aspirational students to start with. And so when you come into a situation and it doesn't feel as successful as one is accustomed to being or something like that, it can feel discouraging, right? One can weed themselves out psychically. And it can feel like it's the grade that's weeding them out, or it's the class that's weeding them out, or the teacher that's weeding them out. But I think that maybe especially what can happen is we can feel psychically self-weeded because we're like comparing to what our own expectations are and our own ideas of what it takes to get to med school. So, you know, if you think you have to have a 4.0 and never have a bump, you know, that's going to be problematic. I've known people who suffered just as much from getting their first B as getting their first C, and maybe only C, but, you know, just because of what it felt like to them. I've seen people give up pre-health for smaller things than, you know, getting C's. And if it takes that, you know, maybe it wasn't something they felt as passionate about fundamentally, but I think that's something to know, is that I don't think there's an external intent amongst most faculty. I can't speak for other schools, and maybe I could say even all faculty, and a purposeful intent to weed people out. I wish I could wave a magic wand to make people not feel weeded out, but I can understand why they do. Yeah.
I think, at least for me, the reason that I feel that a weed out system exists somewhere, maybe not necessarily at Dartmouth, but maybe like in the US education system potentially, mm-hmm. is kind of, I've had this conversation with other people where academia isn't producing what I guess the business world says is in demand. For example, like I just looked up before this how by 2030, the NIH says that we're going to be over 100,000 doctors short in the mm-hmm. US. Mm-hmm. And I mean, common sense would say, okay, so then the academic system is going to push out more doctors to meet that demand. And because there are a lot of people that are interested in it, especially after this pandemic. And it kind of feels like that's not what is happening.
Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
And I was just going to say, that's what makes some people feel that there is a weed out system, if there's so many people interested, and yet we're still at a shortage.
It's a really weird paradox, actually, Anthony and Kushi, because the actual issue isn't at that level. There's a lot of interest, and there's a lot more people who are capable and competitive for med school than can get in. Med schools haven't been able to expand their seats because of the way the residency system works in the US. So the actual barrier isn't here as much as it is. You could double the number of people practically, or at least, you know, quartile, the number of people getting into med school in terms of how many people don't get in every year who are qualified. But there wouldn't be anywhere for them to go after med school. There wouldn't be any positions for them. So it's a weird block in the pipeline. That's actually, interestingly enough, sort of a policy governmental issue, because it's actually a lot of the residency positions are government funded, because it's a time of training you're officially a doctor at that point, but you're still in training, right? And so whatever the system is, the remuneration system for the physicians in training, that's where the problem is, actually. So this is where, you know, policy and pre-health, you know, so we do have a lot of students who are interested in pre-health and public health, or and policy, or and da 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 da, and some people who, as a health profession career, won't go into pre-medicine at all, but will go into policy, healthcare policy, or administrative policy, because there are these other issues or other concerns that are bogging down the process. And then you add to that currently, because of how challenging healthcare can be for a profession, and certainly what's happened in the last few years, there have been professionals who've been close to retirement and went ahead and just bowed out and retired. And so that's added to a little bit of the pool of need growing. So, but no, there's plenty of qualified people who graduate and apply. The acceptance rate nationally into med school is like 45%. And so there's a lot more people applying than can get a seat. And not all the people in the 45% weren't qualified. There's just not enough seats for everybody who's qualified. And that's part of what makes getting into med school so competitive, isn't that there aren't qualified people because the pool's so big and the interest is so strong, the med schools, you know, can pick, you know, from the most competitive seeming people. So kind of an interesting thing. Anyway.
Definitely. I think somebody who's willing to commit so many years and so many resources of them, like of their lives, into becoming doctors and physicians, and having logistical barriers is kind of sad to see. Mm-hmm. But do you think, what issues do you think concern the most? As pre-health advisors, do you think there are some issues that could easily be resolved, and within the education system, among students? What is your opinion with that?
So I am going to need to go in about 1 minute for my next appointment, but I'd be more than glad to talk again if that would be of any interest. Certainly all the things that we even just mentioned, I think that one of my greatest concerns is the degree to which people can kind of lose confidence or lose faith in their abilities because of internal and external feedback. When I think of any aspiration, I think aspiration is like a very precious thing. Usually it's coming from it often sort of a very soulful place in someone. And for some people, whatever is true in their psyche plus their background, it's sort of almost impenetrable. The aspiration's impenetrable. It's going forward no matter what. But for a lot of people, it's fragile. And, you know, there can be, or vulnerable, maybe fragile is the wrong word, vulnerable to meeting some of the challenges that come up in doing such a rigorous path, and or people's perceptions. So I think that's probably the biggest concern I personally wrestle with, is the equity issues involved in, you know, anybody having access to this journey and this path successfully. So that's one aspect of it. And then in terms of people being able to find the resources and find the tools that help them define and individualize their path, not defined in comparative terms to anybody else's path, not having to be at the pace of anybody else's path, but what makes their path successful. And I think that's, I see a lot of people comparing themselves, and that creates an extra stress. And it can also then harm even their overall experience of their education at the college level, because, you know, can kind of lose their joy in the other things they're also learning about, or think, or not even know that they could be having joy in the other things that they're learning. And so, you know, Dartmouth is a liberal arts college. So I really, you know, my goal is also that people feel a sense of joy in learning, period. It's really easy in this path to be defined by your grades instead of the wonder of the content, you know, and, so, and that can lead obviously to mental health stresses that can kind of just really weigh people down, or discourage them from dreaming. So whether it's, I mean, if somebody changes their idea and shifts to another path, I celebrate with them. If that's really coming from their heart, that's fantastic. I'm excited for them. If they're shifting because they just felt discouraged and didn't think they could do it, then that for me feels like a failure, you know, of the system, you know, in a sense.
Well, Sarah, just for me, and I'm sure from all the other students at Dartmouth that you've met, thank you for all the encouraging words. It's a tough path, but with you, like, we can kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel, because we've seen that other people have been able to do it. And it might not be going well now, but with a little bit more work and adjusting things, things will go well. So thank you to you and to all the people at the Pre-Health Advising Office. You guys really make a difference in our academic experience. So thank you.
Thank you so much for saying that. And I know Alicia, our other advisor, is also fantastic and is also helping so many people. So we just really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you both, and excited for your journey. So, and thank you for the work you're doing is to help, you know, your peers and the people you know and don't know. And I think that's awesome what you're all doing. So let me know if you could ever use a thing. And in the meantime, I hope you have a really terrific day and great luck with your own journey. Kushi, great to meet you. And Anthony,
thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
If you like this episode, please consider subscribing and rating our show. It really helps us out a lot. For updates on upcoming episodes or to send in questions for our guest speakers, you can follow us on Instagram at No Scrubs Podcast. That's No Scrubs with a Z. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you had as great of a time as we did.